out, everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and joined on the phone from Cajun Country, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Matt Barganier. He writes the column Collateral Damage for Antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Glad to be here.
It's been a while since you and I have talked. I'm glad to have you back on the show. Welcome back to Radio Chaos. And let's see here. Where was I going to start this thing? Oh, yeah. I was reading a speech by John Kerry that he gave December 3rd at the Council on Foreign Relations. And to hear him tell it, Bush has destroyed the dream of collective security under the United Nations by the way he invaded Iraq. Do you think that that's accurate? And if so, is that really a bad thing?
Well, if that is accurate, then I'd have to say bravo, Mr. Bush. No, that would be a good thing if he had indeed destroyed the whole scheme of United Nations multilateral interventions in countries where the national interests of the United States and other individual countries are not at stake. So if he has in fact done that, and there is an argument to be made that he has done that, we see now that one of the articles in the Los Angeles Times today, allies too busy for role in Iraq, because NATO is preoccupied in Afghanistan. And it does seem that many of our European allies are growing less willing to get involved in these multinational interventions. So if Mr. Bush has in fact done that, then I would say that that's a good thing, although I don't think that he by any means meant to do that. It would simply be a blessed coincidence.
Yes, he did claim over and over again that all he was doing was enforcing UN resolutions.
Right. I mean, what's so funny is that there's a lot of the pro-war commentators on the right play on standard, traditional conservative themes of bashing the UN and bashing multilateralism. And, you know, of course I agree with them about the UN and about multilateralism, but the fact of the matter is that whenever they have to justify war on Iraq, what do they always resort to? They say, well, it wasn't just a unilateral invasion. It was multilateral. We have this grand coalition of the willing, which is, one would think, redundant, and strangely so. And the reason that it was legal, it was sanctioned because of the UN resolutions that Saddam Hussein has violated.
Well, you know, when you talk about some of our European allies are backing off now, I know that seven new countries just joined NATO.
Right.
And they're all, you know, all the way basically to the border of Russia now. And I'm wondering whether you think, I mean, there seems to be a real fight between those in Europe who would prefer maybe to not be so engaged in NATO and maybe have their own European army. And, like, maybe the United States has decided to go ahead and surround them so that basically they're stuck in the NATO alliance with us.
Well, I think the part of this drive to get in on NATO for these new countries, I can't name all of them off the top of my head. I know Romania, Slovakia, is that they're trying to gain prestige and respectability on the one hand, and to show that they have overcome their you know, recent Soviet-dominated past. And so it's kind of like an urban renewal project for them. That it's something that they can tout in EU meetings and in negotiations with the United States. And it's also, of course, a way to get U.S. foreign aid. So that's the motivation of the so-called new European countries, the new Europe, in trying to get on board with NATO and with various U.S. interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as for the rest of Europe trying to build a European army, yeah, I do think that it is are a separate multi-state independent Europe. It is to counterbalance U.S. dominance.
I read in the Times this morning that Russia's complaining and kind of grumbling about the expansion of NATO and F-16s already being based in Lithuania or whatever it was. And I was thinking that, I mean, I don't know. Part of me thinks that, you know, the Germans and the French really are kind of pissed off and really are kind of out of the American loop. But then on the other hand, I mean, Russia's kind of a partner in NATO, too. I mean, it seems like NATO stretches all the way around the entire Northern Hemisphere. And I don't know. I'm not exactly sure where I'm going with that, except that I sort of think it's like a false argument. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, everybody pretends to be opposed to it, but really they're all working toward the same thing.
Right. I think that there's a lot of hedging about that for Russia. They have to, on the one hand, be aware that, or, you know, more specifically Putin, has to be, on the one hand, aware of this thus far largely suppressed animosity on the part of many of the same Americans who are this project for the new American century types, who see Russia as a rival to American benevolent hegemony. But at the same time, and so he's aware of that, the Russian leadership is aware of that, but at the same time, they realize that with the war in Chechnya, they can, to some extent, even if they disagree with similar U.S. actions, like the war on terror, invasion of Afghanistan right along their border, they can play for a little bit of sympathy with the United States and with American audiences and policymakers. Just by having what they construe to be a similar situation on their own hands. So, I think that there's a lot of playing it by ear on their part in terms of NATO expansion and U.S. action, that they're not willing to come out and be openly critical of it, no matter how much it may be inimical to their long-term interest, or they perceive it to be that way.
You wrote your last column is called Unilateralism, the Unknown Ideal, which I like that ripoff of Ayn Rand. I was kind of, I guess the point you make in there is that, you know, if what they were doing was right, they wouldn't really care whether they had any allies or not, but that basically, since what they're doing amounts to just criminal behavior in these invasions, particularly in Iraq, that it's sort of like quantity equals legitimacy. Like, if they can point to, well, Spain's with us and Latvia's with us, then somehow that it's like a gang mentality, you know, where we're doing something wrong, but since we're all doing it together, that kind of makes it okay.
Right. Well, it's supposed to confer legitimacy here. I mean, what we have to understand is that the whole drive for war and all of its various justifications are not unitary, and they're not necessarily consistent. It's the product of not just neoconservative thought, but a number of other different factors, including some amount of the old foreign policy realism. This notion that, you know, foreign policy actions aren't really about moral choices or you know, trying to make the world perfect, that they're about balancing strategic interest and making sure that the rest of the world is stable, whatever that means. And so that's one factor. And of course, on the popular level, it's just flat-out jingoism. You know, most of the people who watch Sean Hannity, for instance, or who post things on Free Republic really don't give a damn about Spain or Latvia or Lithuania being in the coalition. They would support the war just as much if it were the United States alone and, you know, brazenly so. They're just interested in that sort of kick-ass Toby Keith sort of mentality. And so, but they enjoy, they do to some extent enjoy being able to throw up the coalition of the willing thing in the faces of liberals who may criticize so-called American unilateralism. But as I pointed out, it is interesting that the Bush administration does play it both ways. and the people who are around them play it both ways. That when they're in front of, you know, when they're speaking to the larger conservative base, it's all about, you know, look at America, look at how powerful we are, look at how we're making the world better. They don't really play up so much how, you know, Tonga is reforming Iraq. But when they are, you know, when they go to these sorts of traditional establishment institutions and give speeches, Council on Foreign Relations, for instance, and when they give speeches on the campaign trail or debate with the Democrats who might oppose them, they do have to play up this this multilateral angle. And it's really laughable. If you check out some of the links in the article that I have, these U.S. government web pages for each of the coalition participants, you'll find that under it has a little checklist, and it has the flag of all of these various countries, and you can click on each one. And you'll find that under many, it just says page under construction, you know, that they can't exactly figure out what to write for Tonga.
Yeah, are there actually troops from Tonga in Iraq right now?
I don't believe that there are. I think that the Tonga's, Tonga's entire military is something like 400 people. A lot of these countries, though, have sent one or two advisors to CENTCOM, or they've just sent them to Washington, D.C., wants to, you know, to meet with Rumsfeld and shake hands and get a picture taken. And so oftentimes that's listed as strategic support or something.
Okay, well, on September 11th, 2001, some planes crashed into some buildings and killed over 3,000 people. And there has to be a response to that one way or another. So my question to you is, how should the war on terrorism be fought?
These guys are
dangerous.
Right. No, there's no doubt about that. And there does have to be a positive response. I tend to be more interested in... I think that the positive response is fairly obvious in at least in the vaguest terms. You know, as for working out the specifics of it, I'll leave that to others. But in the vaguest terms, I can say that the response is to go after the people who actually perpetrated the crime.
Oh, wow. So you mean individual responsibility.
Right, right.
Oh, interesting.
Instead of, and also not to just, and more importantly, what we've really seen, and it began with Afghanistan. A lot of people have forgotten about Afghanistan. And now even many of the people who vehemently oppose the intervention in Iraq kind of talk wistfully about the invasion of Afghanistan, when in fact it was flawed to begin with. That it wasn't just about going in and finding the individuals or particular groups responsible. That it suddenly became about overthrowing the government of Afghanistan and installing, you know, whatever Western modernity in its place. This conflation of the Taliban, as awful as it was for, you know, the citizens of Afghanistan, but the conflation of the Taliban with Al-Qaeda was just ridiculous. And to go in there and get involved in a civil war there and treat these, you know, these back hills farmers who have really nothing to do with September 11th, probably couldn't find the United States on a map, who are just involved in local tribal warfare, or at the most dramatic, a civil war in Afghanistan, to treat them as if they were responsible for September 11th. It was ridiculous. And that's where this process of conflation really began. It started with the Taliban, and then it expanded outward to Saddam Hussein. And, of course, the ripples just keep going. Now it's of course, all of the Arab governments. And even further on out into the Muslim world, you occasionally get these flashes of hysteria about what's going on in Malaysia, you know. So, yeah, I really think that the response to September 11th very early on got off onto the wrong track.
So it really ought to be a war against Al-Qaeda, not a war on terror, which is basically an open-ended definition there.
Right. Well, you know, even the Al-Qaeda thing is problematic, though, because there's this tendency to speak of Al-Qaeda as this, you know, as if it were IBM, as if it were some sort of multinational corporation that's tightly controlled and hierarchical, when in fact, we don't really know that it is. And it's very easy, as we saw in Madrid, to just automatically say, okay, Muslim terrorist equals Al-Qaeda. And what we see in Iraq all the time, that we're supposed to believe that every roadside bombing and drive-by shooting was officially sanctioned by Osama bin Laden. You know, it's simplistic. And again, the negative response that I would go to, or not again because I didn't really go into it, would be to reduce the causes of this animosity in the first place.
Well, how do we do that? I mean, why is it that they hate us so much? I hear, you know, I listen to a lot of talk radio, and I hear all day long about how these people are just a bunch of religious crazies, man. They're Wahhabists, and they hate everything modern, and they hate our wealth and our liberty, and they want to kill us. How can we possibly take away that motivation?
To a certain extent, those sort of arguments work because they're not fully untrue. The best lie really has as much truth in it as it possibly can. And certainly some of these people who are involved in terrorist groups really do, you know, fully hate everything that America stands for. I think for many other people, though, and for the vast majority of the people who even carry out these terrorist attacks, not to mention the people who merely sympathize with them, are the even larger group who don't sympathize but can understand why they do it, is that the hatred of American culture, for instance, or the American political system, or American people, is really a secondary or tertiary justification for the animosities that are primarily based on U.S. support for Israel, U.S. support for certain regimes throughout the Arab and Muslim world, which may not be sufficiently, Muslim enough, or may be repressive in other ways. So, you know, in other words, for I think the average Arab or Muslim who is hostile to the United States, okay, we're not talking about terrorists here or anything. We're just talking about an average person who does not like the United States. It may be true that somewhere along the line they begin to justify their hatred based on, you know, say Britney Spears or, American democracy, whatever. But they wouldn't care about those things if it weren't for the initial and primary motive that comes from the hatred of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, you know, some guy's driving around right now saying, oh, well, you're just justifying September 11th and saying it's okay.
Well, right. I mean, the people who say that, and they're still saying it, at some point, if you're going to speak intelligently about the war on Iraq and everything that's happened since September 11th, you really just have to ignore those people because they realize, I think that most of them realize that they are being simplistic and that they are conflating explanation with excusing. And it's nothing of the sort. And I could spend my whole day, every day, condemning the acts of September 11th, but I think that it's pretty well understood that I do condemn that, just like everyone else does. And no one is trying to excuse that. We're just trying to say, well, what are the root causes behind it? And unfortunately, those root causes tend to be separated both in the popular imagination because of, you know, faulty reporting and a lack of information, and also just happen to be separated in time, that something will happen that generates the terrorist attack many, many years earlier. The Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, which was ostensibly, according to the U.S. government, it was a Libyan response to Reagan's bombing of Tripoli. But it was separated in time, and so by that, and of course, the American people really never got very much news and or had very much interest. The American media never had very much interest in the bombing of Tripoli to begin with. So, you know, it's hard to get people to see the connection between the two things.
Well, and when they do talk about it, they say that, well, and that taught Gaddafi a lesson, and he never committed an act of terrorism again.
Right. Well, one thing that's very interesting, and I'm not really sure what to make of it. I don't know if you've seen it, but Daniel Pipes' group is now pushing this theory that after all of this Libya bashing, all of this Gaddafi supports terrorism and aha, look at Pan Am 103 and all of that. And of course, the Libyans have denied it for years and years. And even with this recent settlement in which they agreed to pay billions to the families of the victims, you know, one of Gaddafi's top deputies said to a British newspaper, I think, that no, actually, we weren't responsible for Pan Am 103. We still deny that. We're just buying peace with the U.S. It's interesting that one of Daniel Pipes's various groups is now saying, after all of this Libya bashing, that in fact it wasn't Libya. That it was
Syria.
Right, it was Syria. It's, they can
How
just,
did I guess that?
Right, they can just turn on a dime. And, of course, you know, it's not like this comes by way of apologies to Libya or you know, gosh, we should really, you know, take Gaddafi at his word or pursue détente with Libya. No, of course, it's, you know, just keep in mind all that hatred that you erroneously built up for Libya. But, you know, build up some new hatred for Syria. So,
yeah, and of course, like you just mentioned, Libya's back in the news because of this recent détente, and it's been said by all sorts of people all across the political spectrum that the war in Iraq taught Gaddafi a lesson, and he realized that he better go ahead and straighten up his act and start cooperating with the West before he was next.
Yeah, well, again, it's the cause and effect and the lack of reporting beforehand. And that Libya has been trying to do this for years. You know, it really is interesting that response to, or what Gaddafi's deputy said, that we've bought peace with America, is that they're really just looks like they have been desperate for a very long time to just get all of this hostility, mutual hostility, out of the way, and pursue a you know, a more friendly course with the United States, and of course it was going on before the war on Iraq, before September 11th. They've been doing this for years, but of course most people will just look at that and do the, you know, post hoc ergo propter hoc, after this, because of this, and say, well, there you go, it's working.
And you say he was, Gaddafi was trying to warm relations with us even before September 11th?
Yeah, I mean, the Libyans have been trying to do this for a very long time. And when you look at, it's also interesting to kind of go off track a little bit or digress.
We got an hour.
That this nuclear weapons program that they're supposedly giving up, it really just appears to have been nothing at all. And one interesting way of reading that, I think, is that...
Well, hang on one second. Let me stop you there. I thought I read that it was far more expansive than they would have ever imagined.
Well, again, I'm not an expert on it, but I've seen some people who say that it was far more expansive than ever imagined. But, again, putting that in the context of all of this... you know, hue and cry about finding a centrifuge in a garden in Iraq as being a well-developed nuclear program.
Yeah, right.
it's hardly as if the Libyans were, you know, on the verge of wiping out Orlando or something. But it seems to me that what's happening here is it's kind of the Kim Jong-il approach, that with this obsession with weapons of mass destruction and eradicating them, that it has given, at least this is one way of reading it, it has given all of these various little tin-horn dictators around the world a perfect little extortion tool to use, you know, that they can go and pretend to be, pursuing these weapons programs for a while and then trade them in, and you know, suddenly, oh, we've decided to go straight and you know, get, I don't know, U.S. foreign aid, IMF guarantees, whatever.
And this is the game going on in Iran right now, you think, huh?
Well, I'm not sure. I can't say that that's what's happening. I mean, because, of course, on the other hand, and I grant that there's a tension between these two readings, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not true in different cases. I think that on the other hand, this obsession with weapons of mass destruction and this willingness to invade preemptively has led some people who may be further along in already developing weapons programs to say, you know what, we really better get on the ball and we better get something before they decide to invade us. I think that one lesson of Iraq was, you know, if Saddam had had even half of what the U.S. government said he had, he might have been able to forestall that invasion, or at least, you know, inflict significant casualties once it began. So I mean, I think it can go either way here. I think that some guys like Gaddafi, who have been pursuing détente for a very long time, you know, for them, they can use it as a little bargaining chip. And the U.S. government isn't necessarily going to play down that, you know, to they're not necessarily going to contradict the Gaddafis, because it hands them a public relations victory, of course. You know, they can say, well, look, it really is, our policy really is working. We look what Gaddafi did.
Well, and you know, this whole thing with Gaddafi, he apparently has kind of uncovered this gigantic underground network of nuclear technology between Libya, Pakistan, Iran, North Korea. And I just read something, I think it was in last month's New Yorker by Seymour Hersh. He said that the reason that George Bush let the Pakistanis get away with blaming all their sales of all this nuclear technology all on this one scientist was as a quid pro quo for letting American troops into Pakistan. Apparently they're now going to finally try to find bin Laden after 2.5-3 years.
Right. Well, there's no doubt that there is real intent to acquire nuclear weapons. And we might as well dispense with this term weapons of mass destruction, because As many people have explained, most notably again and again, Eric Margolis, that the term is ridiculous in and of itself. That what they're trying to do again is conflate these small-time tactical battlefield weapons like nerve gas with nuclear weapons. You know, it's taking a bullet and putting it in the same category as a bomber, and so we should just really get rid of that term altogether and just talk about nuclear weapons technology. And there's no doubt that there is sincere effort being put into acquiring nuclear programs. And I think that's the less sunny side. If we could say that, you know, the little sort of perhaps extortion techniques are on the sunny side, and that, you know, at most they cost some money, in foreign aid, then this is really the darker side, that there is sincere intent to develop these weapons in certain places.
And, of course, delivery of them is an entirely different question. I don't know that Iran can launch a missile into orbit and drop a bomb on the continental United States. It would probably take them 30 years to
Right, that's true. But what's interesting about that is that I mean, even the way that you said that, and, you know, you're talking about actual national defense. Well, we're not involved in the national defense business anymore. They don't have to be able to threaten the United States. They just have to be able to threaten somebody. And particularly, if you're in the Middle East, that could just be Israel. You find any sort of way to deliver anything to Israel, and supposedly, by U.S. foreign policy logic, that's our concern.
Well, let's hold that thought and get back to Israel a bit later. I want to focus on what you said about the weapons of mass destruction. How it's sort of it's a term that's so vague that I remember reading, and I think the judge dismissed the case, but there was a prosecutor in Georgia or Alabama or something somewhere who tried to indict a guy for weapons of mass destruction for having a meth lab.
Right, right. I think that was in Virginia, actually.
Oh, Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's obviously, it's on the domestic law enforcement front, what you see is that these conflations are starting to come home and starting to be used by overeager prosecutors, both on the local and federal level. And yeah, it's ludicrous. All of the talk about chemical and biological weapons is also very useful because, as we saw with Clinton's raid on that aspirin factory and or whatever pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, you can find evidence if you're looking hard enough for it. You can find evidence of there being chemical weapons. You know, it's as if you say any place that has fertilizer obviously has the intent to build truck bombs.
Right. Well, and it kind of reminds me of, I don't know, it's all like a big George Carlin skit to me about language and how you just reinvent some terms and then do what you like with them. And it reminds me of assault weapon, you know, fully automatic machine guns or rifles have been illegal in this country since the days of Franklin Roosevelt. And yet, when they say assault weapon, most people think that means fully automatic, but what it really means is any scary-looking gun that they feel like banning.
Right.
And
right.
They can just keep adding guns to the list. And, you know, I heard, you know, it's to me the same thing with the prosecutor in the meth lab. They said that the airplanes that attacked those buildings on September 11th, that those were weapons of mass destruction. And I thought, you know, I mean, obviously those were really tall buildings full of lots and lots of people, and 3,000 people dying is a lot, but mass destruction, I don't know about that. Seems like if it had been a jet plane shooting one missile into that building, it would have caused the same damage.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the real weapons of mass destruction are, of course, conventional weapons, the conventional weapons that the U.S. and many other countries use all the time. But this use of language, I mean, it's an old theme, but it's constantly applicable. I think, for instance, with the recent events in Fallujah and the attempt to drum up outrage over this, and by the way, I'm not to say that people shouldn't be outraged or upset about it, but to drum up outrage on the grounds that these were American civilians being killed, which is problematic in the first place, is you probably know Peggy Noonan compared it to September 11th, which is, you know, not just ridiculous in terms of the ratio, but ridiculous in that on September 11th there was an attack here in the United States. It wasn't American citizens halfway around the world in a very dangerous place, fully cognizant of the risk of being there. But it's even more ridiculous because these people were not, by any meaningful sense of the term, civilians. That doesn't make it right what happened to them, but it is deceptive and manipulative to use this, oh my gosh, they were civilians, look at them killing American civilians, as if these guys were missionaries or something.
Right, they were mercenaries is what they were, really.
Well, what I went and looked up, it's Blackwater Security Consulting is the company that they were employees for, and you can find them on the web. I believe it's blackwatersecurity.org or .com, and they actually have a job description page for you to send in resumes and describe several of the different jobs that they have, and it's very interesting. I printed it out. You know, not because I'm looking for a new line of work or anything, but just out of interest in what was required. And this is a line from it. Must be retired or released from active duty within the last 24 months or maintain skill sets through other independent contracting opportunities. And these skill sets include hostage rescue, close quarter battle, structure penetration, intelligence collection, reconnaissance and surveillance, sniper, counter-sniper operations, visit board search and seizure operations, small unit tactics, raid conduct and training, force protection. You know, these sound, you know, perhaps I'm just being a little muddle-headed here, but it sounds to me as if you're doing all of these things and getting paid by the U.S. Department of Defense, and you're there with the blessing of the U.S. Department of Defense, that you are not a civilian.
I don't understand why they would even have these private contractors at all. I mean, that just sounds like the job description of somebody in the Army.
Well, I think it's because using these guys, they can, a lot of what these guys do can escape public scrutiny. And it may not be held to the same alleged standards of accountability that actual members of the U.S. military are held to. These guys, for instance, I would, you know, can't be court-martialed, and I'm not sure under what jurisdiction they could possibly be prosecuted for anything that they happen to do in Iraq.
That's a very good point. In fact, I think I even read something about they were some of these private contractors were testing out their some kind of new bullets, explosive bullets, just by apparently murdering people, driving by and shooting them, and going, "Wow, did you see the hole it blew in that guy?" And,
right.
And yeah, like you say, they can't be court-martialed for that, or have anything happen to them. And on this Fallujah thing, Fox News, which I assume that they would give the most conservative numbers that they could possibly come up with, they said yesterday that 70% of Iraqis support the attacks against the U.S. troops.
Yeah, actually, I was just reading that, and it's more specifically, it's the one that I read says 70% in that region, in and around
Fallujah. In Fallujah, okay.
Right. Versus, it was a much lower number. For the country as a whole. Of course, for the country as a whole, it includes certain places like in, you know, the northern Kurdish-controlled areas where it's a completely different story. You know, it's not even as if there is an American occupying force as such or that presents itself, you know, that way. So, I mean, the numbers for the whole country are kind of misleading. It is very interesting that, though, in that area, it is 70%.
Well, and that brings up the question of how the hell are we ever going to get the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shia, once they have a democracy, supposedly, under this new constitution, how can we expect them to actually, you know, I mean, the United States is supposedly at least a federal republic of all these semi-sovereign states that all have a hell of a lot in common with each other. And it seems like the Kurds and the Sunnis, I can't really imagine them getting along together in the House of Representatives. And
well, yeah, you know, especially when, as some outraged neoconservative I heard last night on C-SPAN mentioned, that on the Iraqi Governing Council there are two Iranian parties, you know. I mean, my God, as if the country isn't fractious enough on its own. But, yeah, you know, if you want to kind of get some sort of picture of what Iraqi self-governance, at least in the near term, is going to be like, a Financial Times article, I believe from yesterday, about a Shiite militia going into an Iraqi town that's long been famous for prostitution and freely serving alcohol and so forth, and just really laying waste to the place. Kalia, I believe is how it's pronounced. And this is, you know, this is the sort of prospect that I think that a lot of these guys, I mean, some of them are actually being semi-honest now, you know, even very thick-headed people like Fred Barnes, who have been there and who was, you know, a huge cheerleader for the war, Fred Barnes from Fox News, Weekly Standard, and now saying, well, gosh, this might not be as easy as we thought it was going to be.
Oh, you don't say. Well, it's, I mean, honestly, this is why we didn't take Baghdad in 1991, is that they said as much. James Baker said, look, if we take Baghdad, then basically we have three new countries to deal with. And the Kurds in the north, if we let them have Kurdistan, well, the Kurds in Turkey are going to try to join up with them. And then we're going to have to, you know, Turkey's been our ally for 50 years. They're in NATO, and so we're going to have a whole problem with them, and so that's why it wasn't worth it to take out Saddam Hussein in the first place.
Yeah, it's really amazing how the second Bush administration has engendered in me almost a sort of wistful nostalgia for the first Bush administration. Okay. I didn't think that was possible. But yeah, I mean, as bad as those guys were, and as bad as the whole theory of foreign policy, so-called realism that they espoused was, it was light years ahead of what we have now. And particularly, just the cluelessness of these people. There are so many things. It just seems like everything that comes out today is something that they should have thought about before they decided to invade this country. And they always talk about, oh, well, we're just about to round the corner. They're always just about to do something. And under any circumstance, that is not news, and that is not a legitimate thing to even report, that somebody is about to do something. You know, we've been hearing forever how they're about to capture Saddam, or how they're about to capture Osama bin Laden. Until you do it, it's not news. And so in Iraq, we continue to get these things about how they're just about to get everything to gel, and they're just about to hand over power to the Iraqis, and everything's just about to be fine. Well, call me when all of those things happen, but it's not news, nor even a particularly interesting gossip to say that anything is just about to happen.
Yeah, well, and from where I sit, it looks like everything's going to hell. I mean, I read something yesterday where a Shiite cleric came out and gave this great speech endorsing Hamas. Saying how, you know, they're our brothers in arms and this and that. And these are the Shia, these are the moderates, the good guys who are most cooperative with us over there.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, that in and of itself is bizarre, right? That the Shiites, too, I remember when I was a kid and, you know, there would be hijackings, there would be, you know, various Middle Eastern foreign policy problems that I always heard about Shiite extremists. Seems like I've heard about that my entire life until the invasion of Iraq, in which the Shiites are suddenly, you know, these nice, mild-mannered guys. And I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just saying it's interesting, this self-serving, just total turnaround in U.S. government rhetoric.
Yeah, well, and, you know, if this whole thing was to benefit Israel, it doesn't sound like it's working very well. I mean, if the Shia are the majority and hold the power in Iraq after we transfer, if we ever do, you know, having them back Hamas when Saddam Hussein was prepared to switch sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and was prepared to support Israel if as one of the conditions to avert war. I mean,
yeah, well, it's interesting. Saddam's relation to the entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been, some parts of it have been emphasized, you know, that he supposedly, you know, paid for suicide bombers, and that is technically true, that what he did do, that he had a long-standing policy long before the suicide attacks began of giving money to the families of Palestinians who were killed in the conflict, you know, killed in any sort of way, whether they were shot by Israelis or whether they got themselves shot. And so, of course, that he just continued that policy. So it's not as if, you know, he was really, you know, the driving force behind suicide bombing or anything. One of the criticisms that we frequently hear of the Arab states, and I'm not saying that it's, you know, again, it's not totally unfounded, is that they haven't opened their arms to take in Palestinian refugees. That, for instance, Jordan, you know, keeps them basically herded into this little narrow strip on their west. Is that, you know, Saddam, of course, it was largely just window dressing for pan-Arab sentiment, but he, of course, did take in Palestinian refugees, and, you know, a small number. So, yeah, as to whether this is going to be on the whole good for Israel in the end, it seems extremely dubious. But, of course, that's more because of the illogic and mismanagement than it is because it wasn't intended to be good for Israel.
it sort of seems like this whole thing is counterproductive, but then part of me thinks maybe that's the point, to have this policy that creates more and more terrorism. After all, our leaders promised us that this was going to last our whole lifetimes. Maybe they don't want a quick, easy solution to this.
Well, they definitely don't want a quick, easy solution, which is not quite the same thing as saying that they want more terrorism. I think that they see it, and again, the they here would be sort of the intellectual wing of Bush foreign policy, the people who are usually identified as neoconservatives. I think that the way that they look at it is that this is an inevitable clash that has to happen, and there's going to be lots of casualties, and there's going to be lots of terrorism no matter what, and so it's best to just go ahead and get it over with. I think that is an entirely faulty analysis. I believe that if the U.S. government quit interfering in all over the world, but more specifically in the Arab and Muslim world, that we would see terrorist attacks against the United States disappear overnight. But that's the way that they see it. They see these things as being inevitabilities, or as being necessary evils.
If the thing that pisses them off the most is our support of Israel, is it realistic to think that America should just stop supporting Israel and just, all right, you guys are on your own?
Is it realistic in the sense that it's likely to happen anytime soon?
Or that, you know, it wouldn't lead to all the Jews being pushed into the sea?
We often hear that. I'm not so sure that's true at all. To go ahead and just make to make it clear, the United States is not responsible for the defense of any other country. That is a totally wrong-headed notion, and one that leads to unnecessary trouble for U.S. civilians.
Now, that is absolutely shocking. Can you please repeat that? America is not responsible for what again?
For the defense of any other country, whether it be Israel or whether it be, Italy, where we still have bases, or Japan or Taiwan. Taiwan is often a big source of agitation every time that the Chinese threaten the Taiwanese. But really, along the same lines, I know this is a bit digression, but it's an interesting one, that the Chinese communists basically assert the Bush doctrine in regards to Taiwan, that if the Taiwanese try to procure nuclear weapons, then that gives the Chinese the right to respond, or to preempt it, in fact. So, but no, the United States is not obligated to defend any of those places. As for what the result would be if the United States stopped doing that, it's hard to say. I believe that it would probably, that until that happens, there's no way that there's going to be reconciliation between Israel and any of its neighbors until the United States is out of the equation. Now, as to whether the Israelis would be willing to do what it takes, and whether their neighbors would be willing to do what it takes for that reconciliation, that's an entirely different matter. But our responsibility, as I see it, is to simply quit being part of the problem and quit wasting U.S. taxpayer dollars and making U.S. civilians targets because of this conflict, which is not ours. It's the same thing in Iraq. Whether things are going to work out in Iraq in the long run is not up to us. It's up to the Iraqis and, you know, how they choose to work things out. It may turn out to be a dismal failure. It may turn out to be, they may turn out to be able to, you know, pick themselves up from the dictatorship of Saddam and U.S. invasion and years of sanctions and actually come up with a solution. But our role here is to get out, because we are not going to make that solution. We can't make it. We're prolonging this miserable afterbirth of the Hussein regime and making ourselves targets and running ourselves, our treasury, into the ground with it.
Well, why is it, do you think? I mean, we obviously have obligations all over the world at this point for all sorts of reasons. But why is it, do you think, that we're so beholden to Israel, especially on the right? I mean, what's so special about Israel as compared to, I don't know, Canada? Anybody?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. It would take years to even begin to formulate an answer to that. There are a lot of different reasons. One of the things that we've seen in recent times is that very many people in this country, among the conservative base of the Republican Party, people who are, you know, either not really that particularly interested in Israel, and in some cases who are outright anti-Semitic, and you know, openly so, are interested in Israel for reasons that have to do with certain Christian fundamentalist creeds. And I think that is a huge factor right now in terms of Republican Party strategy.
Well, what are we talking about here? The Book of Revelations?
Right, that it's about fulfilling, that you have to maintain a state of Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy. Of course, one of the interesting things in this is that some of these dispensationalists believe is that, of course, this isn't going to be a rosy scenario for actual Israelis. It's going to end in a terrible bloodbath for the Israelis. But in the meantime, you got to support the state of Israel and keep it around long enough for that bloodbath to happen and all of the ensuing, you know, wonderful apocalyptic things after. That's one thing. Of course, there's also support in the Democratic Party, and traditionally the Democratic Party has been much more vigorously pro-Israel, which, you know, in large part has to do with ethnic voting blocs in New York and other places. I think also there's an interesting, I don't know if you caught it this morning on C-SPAN, Norman Finkelstein had, I think it was a two-hour speech. He has a new book called Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. And it's his contention that for many of these people, like Cheney, they don't really care one way or the other about Israel. It's just that that Israel has become an appendage of U.S. foreign policy that they can't get rid of. That it's you know, a place to anchor U.S. influence in the Middle East, and that's as far as their interest in Israel goes. And of course, on the other hand, for many other people, it would be the other way around. That in fact, it's very odd to see this tiny little country, both in terms of geography and population, having such enormous influence in a much larger country. In fact, one person has said that it's the only case in world history of an enormous state and a tiny state, and the enormous state is you know, it's the servant.
Yeah, that's funny. In fact, I was about to mention that. I thought it was something that you had written, or maybe it was, and you were linked to that. Yeah, the thing about, you know, that traditionally empires have the client states do their fighting for them. And in this case, the client state has the empire come from across the ocean to fight their war.
Right, and but you know, to go back to the what will happen to Israel thing, again, I'm not sure, and that's up to them in large part. But I do think that after all of these years of giving such enormous military aid and basically propping up their socialist economy, you know, I don't think anyone could say that the United States hasn't done everything it possibly can to assure Israel's continued existence, and I think it would be extreme ingratitude to impugn the motives of American citizens for saying at this point, hey, keep all the goodies we gave you, but that's it.
Yeah, doesn't sound so anti-Semitic to me.
Right, unfortunately, and that's one of the things that Finkelstein talks about. It's really a very good talk. I'm not sure if they're going to do an encore of it or not. You can check that on cspan.org. But as he talks about how, you know, that has that charge has really been used and just used to death almost exclusively for the purposes of supporting the government of Israel. And it should be pointed out, of course, and I say this as a libertarian, that the government of Israel, the state of Israel, is, of course, a separate entity from Israeli citizens. The two are not to be conflated. And when people make anti-Israel arguments in which they conflate the two, I object to those. But I also object to arguments that by somehow opposing the Israeli state, you oppose the Israeli citizenry or the larger Jewish population of the world. It's absolutely absurd.
Well, and that is the accusation. I mean, even if you're Jewish and you have something to say about it, well, then you're a self-hating Jew.
Right. It's really sickening, and I think that it has been very effective for a long time, but I think that we're starting to see a decline in that. I think that there's going to be less and less attention paid to those sorts of accusations, and I think in part because it's now transcended a left-right issue. There used to be a very long period in which such accusations of anti-Semitism were almost exclusively thrown from the left at people on the right. And now it is just broken down completely to where, you know, you have these alliances of left and right groups domestically here in the United States, and of course in Israel too, just branding everybody an anti-Semite. They have overplayed the card. And so I think that the effectiveness of that smear is going to decline.
Well, I hope you're right about that. It's funny, it kind of brings to mind the whole debate over The Passion, Mel Gibson's movie, and whether it was the Jews who killed Jesus or this and that, which just brings to my mind that, you know, even if Pontius Pilate had been a Jew and it was nothing but Jews that killed Jesus, so what? That was 2,000 years ago, and all those people were individuals, and they're all dead. And it's, to me, just preposterous to think that somehow, you know, people who had nothing to do with act in history bear some collective responsibility. You know, that's like saying that, you know, my family that all, in its entirety, my family all moved to the United States after 1900, and yet somehow I owe reparations for slavery.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, the collective, so many, I mean, so much of thought in this country and everywhere in the world, of course, is unfortunately collectivist. Again, to point to this, just because it's fresh in my mind, one of the things that Finkelstein points out, and I didn't hear this, I read the news every day, and you know, to the point that my eyes are bleary and I can barely stand to read another line, and I don't recall ever coming across this or hearing it on the news, the nightly news, is that a recent Pew study came out, and it was examining attitudes about anti-Semitism in the United States and Great Britain and I believe 8 continental European countries. And it found that between now and the last time that such a survey was done in 1991, that the numbers had just declined dramatically. I mean, they were pretty low before, but they've gotten lower in every single country, including these places which we're supposed to believe are hotbeds of anti-Semitism, like France. It's gone down everywhere, and that's not reported because it's just all so bound up in the politics of Israel. That if you report that, you know, the whole world is not this, you know, we hear all the time the people who use the anti-Semite smear, they always say that everyone's talking about a Jewish conspiracy. But, of course, they're always talking about an anti-Semitic conspiracy. And so, you know, evidence to the contrary does them no benefit. It doesn't benefit Israel's interests if, in fact, we can look around the world and see that, you know, there's not this huge anti-Semitic conspiracy. It's really become a very fringe phenomenon. And that so many of the people who are accused of it just simply are not guilty of it.
Yeah, note to David Brooks, that joke's not funny anymore, right?
Right, and before that, Ran HaKohen, another antiwar.com columnist who actually lives in Israel, he's an Israeli Jewish citizen, pointed out in an article that, you know, again, if we look at all of the, if we looked at it objectively, anti-Semitism in the West certainly it has been on a long decline. And so we have to wonder, then, why do we constantly hear about this? And why, for instance, are the attacks that have happened in France, why are they decontextualized? Why are we led to believe that's actually, you know, regular native-born Gallic French doing this instead of course, you know, the disaffected Muslim groups that are recent immigrants there. I mean, it's important to point those things out. And of course, I mean, if you want to look at their hostility, then of course it goes back to the question of Israel. But it's not as if the French are, you know, on the whole or even a large minority anti-Semitic, or that's the reason that the French government is say less friendly with Israel than the United States government is.
Well, you kind of got me hoping that maybe that the reason anti-Semitism is on such a decline is maybe individualism is back on the rise. Maybe people are finally starting to get it that, no, individuals are individuals and they're only responsible for themselves and nobody else. Think?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Right. Well, that would certainly be one optimistic way of interpreting it. And there may be something to that. I hope that is the case. I also hope that you know, the logic is applied across the board, and that instead of just branding everyone who's an opponent of Israel an anti-Semite, that we look at people on an individual basis and see, you know, what their actual arguments are.
Well, we're already over an hour here. I got some more questions, but I'll let you go if you got to go.
I can run through a few more. I'm starting to lose my voice again, but I can probably go for maybe another 10 minutes.
Good deal. There's a whole big flap about old Richard Clark and his testimony before the September 11th Commission, where basically he accused the Bush administration of doing absolutely nothing and even refusing to pay attention to the threat from Al-Qaeda in the months before September 11th. And, of course, sort of a repeat of this whole show is nothing but smears. Nobody ever really attacked what he had to say, only him and his personality. And I just wondered what you think of all that.
I really don't have anything new to say about that that hasn't been said before, but it is interesting how similar it is to the whole Clintonian approach. It is just remarkable. If you look at something, a document from the end of the Clinton era, such as that Christopher Hitchens book, No One Left to Lie To,
right,
in which Hitchens talks about just, you know, this abysmal behavior on the part of the Clintons and how they would just smear every single person who came out with accusations against Clinton, and particularly just incredibly reprehensible stuff, like I believe when Paula Jones first filed her sexual harassment claim, James Carville comes out and says something to the effect of, oh, this is what happens when you drag a $20 bill through a trailer park, and just how similar the Bush approach has been to all of these supposedly disgruntled former employees. And of course, even that term disgruntled in itself is loaded. I mean, if you ask anyone over the age of 25, if you play free association with them and say disgruntled, you know what they're going to say back. They're going to say postal worker or post office. I mean, for those of us of a certain age who recall, you know, the rash of all of these post office shootings, the person in question, the shooter, was always called disgruntled. I mean, that's what it means. That's its deeper, you know, subtext in the popular imagination. But to not even let it rest with that, you know, the rumors that are just flying around, and you can guess fairly well where they're coming from, about Richard Clark's sexual orientation, it, just these people really, really, the whole time that they were bashing the Clintons for doing the same thing, they were studying. They were paying attention.
Yeah, it's all pretty much the same. I've often joked that Bush Jr. is really a lot more like Clinton Jr. than he is Bush Jr.
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities, more similarities than all across the board in foreign policy and domestic, but particularly I think in media handling. And to some extent you can just say that, okay, well, you know, in Clinton in 8 years and all the guys who are around him, like Carville and Begala, just changed the landscape so much that, you know, you can't go back. I find that ludicrous, but whatever. It is interesting that they used so many of the same tactics, and they did the same thing with Paul O'Neill, and just one person after another. I mean, my God, they have generated a lot of disgruntlement.
Yeah. Well, and another part of this story is it seems like the spin is that, you know, in not doing enough, what we really should have done was invaded Afghanistan before September 11th, and that's the lesson we learned.
Yeah, well, there are definitely problems with Clark's logic. I mean, you have to look at Clark as being, again, kind of one of these perhaps more old-school foreign policy realists, and again, that's their own designation. I don't use that approvingly. And there were lots of problems with that, too, although, again, I think it's probably less bad than what we have now. Yeah, there are lots of problems with his ideas about what should have happened. I'm not necessarily on board with those, but the more relevant point is not necessarily his own analysis about how things should have gone down, but about how things actually did go down. That's the more relevant point. And you know, just the other day in The Independent, there's an article about this whistleblower, a former FBI translator, who claims flat out that all of these smears of Clark and these rebuttals to what he said are that she can prove that senior officials knew about this Al Qaeda air attack plan well before 9/11. Of course, again, I have to say one of the things in Clark's testimony, he apologized for the U.S. government, and on the one hand, I don't know, I guess there is something admirable about that, but I'm not sure that he quite apologized for the correct thing. What we deserve an apology for is this foreign policy that has created these problems, not necessarily that the government has been unable to stop every form of blowback, because there's no way, no matter how vigilant they are, that they can stop every instance of terrorism, every response to their foreign policy meddling. There is no way. I mean, and in a sense, I guess that puts me in a weird agreement with the Bush defenders, that there is no way that they can defend against everything, which is a reason not to provoke all of these attacks in the first place.
Good point. Now, one more thing here. Graham, Senator, Bob Graham from Florida, former senator.
Yeah, yeah.
Ex-presidential candidate. He gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations the other day and alluded, I guess, for the second time. He had talked about this once before on PBS, that in their report, in the Senate Intelligence Committee report, that they had found that there were state sponsors of the September 11th attacks. And the way he said it on PBS, I think, was more general. But the way he said it at the Council on Foreign Relations last week, he seemed to be alluding to countries not including Saudi Arabia, and he held up a copy of his report and showed all the blank pages that had been classified by the Bush administration about these other state sponsors. And I wonder if you have any educated guesses as to who he may be talking about there.
Well, I actually didn't see that, so I can't. I'm really not sure who he was, who he might have been implying. I think, though, in terms of keeping secret, you know, it benefits this neoconservative agenda to keep things in the dark. You know, if you can say, oh, there were other people involved, and I know that Graham is not part of that. In this part, he may be in what he's, what you described, he may be acting, however, as a dupe. It does serve their interest to kind of keep this suspense, to keep these secrets, so that if you can say, oh, there's this wide terror network and there are all these state sponsors, but we can't tell you who, then, you know, whenever it becomes necessary, as they see it, to invade another country, they can say, this is one of those. This is one of those ones that we didn't tell you about before.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of the same thing that they did in the run-up to the war against Iraq was, well, hey, man, I don't think there's any evidence of weapons of mass destruction at all. Well, the president must have secret information that we don't know about.
You hear that all the time, and particularly at the popular level. I recall something from a couple of weeks ago from Dennis Miller's Execrable show on CNBC, where he said something to the effect of, you know, when Powell gave his presentation to the UN, I think that's what he was referring to, that if this is the stuff that they could tell us in public, then just imagine all of the dreadful information that President Bush had access to. Well, you know, okay, my imagination's running wild. I'm not sure what purpose that serves, however.
Right.
I mean, I'm honest to God, you know, if the stuff that Powell said at the UN was just the tip of the iceberg, then I really do have to shake my head in wonderment at what the hell they were saying to George Bush. I mean, you know, some sort of mutant army of clones or something. What could they have possibly said that was more hysterical than what they did say?
Right, yeah, like the Bill Hicks thing about 12-foot-tall desert warriors, the Republican Guard.
Yeah.
And how first they were the Republican Guard, or first they were the elite Republican Guard, then they were the Republican Guard, and then they were, well, the Republicans made up this shit about there being a guard out there at all.
Right. It's amazing how, you know, and I think that this is probably, you know, that has less to do with political spin, I think, this portrayal of, you know, the elite Republican Guard. It goes back in time. It's part of military culture to portray the enemy. You know, you don't want to say that you just went and ran roughshod over some patsies. You have to, you know, make the enemy look grander than they were. There's a book by Nina Silver called The Romance of Reunion, which talks about how this happened in the post-Civil War era. That, you know, during the Civil War, there was all of this mockery by one side or the other, the North and South, you know, about, you know, the effeminacy of the other side and all this stuff. But then, of course, after the war, when you want to go tell all your great war stories, you have to make it sound as if the other guys really were just some unbelievable warriors.
Right. I love it. All right, everybody, you understand why I'm such a big fan of this guy. Matt Barganieri writes Collateral Damage for antiwar.com. You got any closing comments, anything I left off?
No, just I hope everybody keeps checking out the site, and I have to get perhaps a little bit more in rhythm and writing more often than I have been lately. Been kind of falling down on the job there, but also check out our weblog, because I have a lot of stuff on there, and so do various other people at antiwar.com have sort of breaking news things up on there. So check that out too.
Well, Matt, out of the two of us, you're the great writer, so I know Eric Harris is going to want a good title for this interview. What do you want to call it?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea.
Okay, we'll call it I Have No Idea. You with Matt Barganier.
All right, thank you.
Thanks again for coming on the show, man.
No problem, anytime.
All right, everybody. I am Philip Drew, administrator. This is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM. And that was Matt Bargainier. He writes a great column for antiwar.com, y'all. You really ought to check it out. It's called Collateral Damage. And in fact, I want to read the, a couple of these. Not the whole column or anything, don't worry. Matt wrote this thing, back last October, called "Dude, you got like totally planed," a glossary for these times, and I want to read you a couple of these. Never do I laugh so hard about war and people dying as when I'm reading Matt's columns. Let's see, the definition of anti-Americanism, noun, a neurosis associated with the followers of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Quincy Adams. And of course, all three of those names are links to speeches they gave about how we ought to stay out of foreign entanglements. Anti-Semite, noun, 1, a person who concedes that Arabs might be human. 2, whomever David Frum happens to be arguing with at any given time. Baathist, noun, an Iraqi who favors self-determination for his or her country. Democrat, noun, a politician whose fevers of moral rectitude and fiscal restraint can only be cooled by inauguration. Democratically, adverb, how civilized people loot, oppress, and murder one another, as opposed to the informal methods of barbarians. Habeas corpus, a talisman for terrorists. Halabja, a village in northern Iraq where, in 1988, the American-funded Iraqi or American-funded Iranian government gassed thousands of Kurds to the skillfully understated horror of the Reagan administration. 2, a rhetorically weak effort to exploit suffering for political gain. Colin Powell's Halabja was no Gettysburg Address. Israel, noun, a state whose distance from America's capital belies its proximity to America's capital. Kaaba, the point to which the staff of National Review turns 5 times daily and envisions nuclear holocaust. Massacre, noun, see Halabja. Do not, under any circumstances, see Sabra and Shatila. Neoconservative, noun, a person who believes the prefix neo to mean anything but. Neoconserve. To squander. Creating zip codes for Iraq is a great way to neoconserve taxpayer money. Palestinians, noun, a group that arose ex nihilo in 1948 to exploit Israeli hospitality. Patriot Act, noun, an attempt to use a puerile acronym to render innocent an odious and tyrannical law. See also Victory Act. Patriotic, adjective, 1, American usage, idolizing Tony Blair, Rupert Murdoch, and Ariel Sharon. 2, professing certainty about the moral, intellectual, and aesthetic supremacy of one's own nation-state over all others, a universal tendency. Claim, to make a pink slip of the tongue. Quagmire, a word of indeterminate meaning. All that is certain is that it has nothing to do with open-ended military and financial commitments. And I'll let you off the hook with this one here. Republican, a creature whose rationality fluctuates in inverse proportion to its power. All right, everybody, that was a little bit from Matt Bargainier's column, Collateral Damage, on antiwar.com. I hope you check it out. I think you'll really like his stuff. And you know what I'm going to do right now? I'm going to give a little bit of props to my radio station, Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.
In a world plagued by greed, Limp Bizkit, Barry Manilow. One station stands alone, ejaculating a contemptuous load into the face of mainstream mediocrity. For profit, the system told them what was good. Chaos played them what they wanted to hear. This summer, you're listening to one movie. We don't care because we're a radio station.